What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping
you? I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Thursday afternoon. Delighted to have you with us. This program is for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, please feel free to consider us as a primary source to get those questions answered. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. Also, you can text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response. Once you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And of course, you can always send us an email, ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. All right, Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski handling the phone screening. Ace McKay is on social media. I'd like to say hello to all of you who are listening to us on YouTube and the EWTN app today. We're delighted to have you with us. All right, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm well. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing decent, thank you.
Interesting question here from John in North Las Vegas as we're getting some of these calls screened. Dr. Anders, at confession, we are told to tell our sins in kind and number. Now, does this mean if we can't remember the number, we're not forgiven? Do I need to carry a notebook to keep track? And am I being a little too scrupulous? Thanks, John in North Las Vegas.
Answering the last question first, yes, you're being too scrupulous. Answering next to last question, please do not carry a notebook. Please, please, please do not carry a notebook.
Yeah.
Here's what you do. All right, Father, it's been, you know, X amount of time since my last confession.
Yep.
I did such and such a lot of times. I don't know how many. I did it a bunch. Or I did it a few, and I don't know how many.
That'll work.
That'll get the job done. You're not being dishonest. You know, the point of the kind and number thing is that you're not deliberately concealing something that mm-hmm. you've done wrong from the priest, right? As long as you're making a good faith effort to, you know, be straight with him, that's the idea.
John in North Las Vegas, thanks so much for your question. Here's one now from, looks like, Gerard, who says, I heard years ago that the correct translation of porneia in Scripture as it relates to divorce is, quote, unlawful. This makes sense, but today I see unchastity used in Catholic Bibles. Unchastity does not make sense. If you want a divorce, an annulment, all you have to do is have an affair? That's not Scripture truth or church teaching. Please help at Gerard.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate the question. So first of all, even if the word were translated unchastity, the application you have drawn, namely, if I want to get a divorce, the best thing to do is cheat on my wife, and then I can lawfully divorce. That would be the wrong conclusion to draw. Right?
We don't recommend that.
Yeah, that's not the position.
No,
right?
No.
And you know, when it comes to infidelity, what the church says is if you have a validly married couple,
okay,
and one cheats on the other, that the abused spouse is not obligated to continue in conjugal living with the adulterer. The person certainly can continue in conjugal living, and they could forgive the adulterer, but they're not morally obligated to, and so they could separate. Or they could live under the same roof but refuse marital intimacy legitimately.
But it wouldn't
invalidate the marriage, right? The marriage would still stand, and so you would just be two married people living apart indefinitely. And Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians. He says, you know, don't divorce your spouse, but if you do, you remain unmarried or else be reconciled to your spouse,
yeah,
right? And
yeah.
I know people in this situation, folks, married couples that are validly married, and for whatever reason they've had to separate and they live separately, but they understand themselves to be validly sacramentally married, but like unable to live under the same roof right now, you know?
Sure.
So that would be the application you would draw, not to, I get to commit adultery and divorce my wife. No, sorry, you can't do that. All right.
No.
And really, the thing is more with an eye to protecting the rights and the dignity of the person who's been cheated against, not the cheater.
Okay.
Right, you know?
All right.
Now, in terms of the actual translation, so the word's ambiguous, and it covers a lot of ground in New Testament Greek,
mm-hmm.
but it definitely includes the idea of unions that would violate the boundaries of consanguinity, right? That you can't marry somebody within a certain degree of proximity within your familial relations. And so in 1 Corinthians, for example, when Paul talks about the fellow who is he's got his stepmother. Well, that was ruled out by Jewish law. You could not lawfully marry your stepmother.
Yeah.
That would also fall under the rubric of porneia, right? And that's exactly the kind of situation that the church has in mind when it looks for grounds of nullity, right? Is there something intrinsic to the nature of this relationship
uh-huh.
that would make it impossible for you to contract a legal marriage with them? And there are many other instances. So the classic case would be, the sailor who has who has a family in every port, right? You know,
yeah.
Sorry, you can't do that, bud.
No.
You can only have one wife at a time. You know,
yes.
If a guy's already got one wife, that makes him he is not eligible to take a second one, right? That's ruled out. That would if he attempted to contract that union with another woman, it would automatically be invalid, all other things being equal, right? Interesting ground for nullity, and I've thrown this one out before, but I've never actually seen it done.
Yeah.
This is the King David law, right? You actually cannot lawfully marry a woman if you murder her husband to make her eligible.
Wow.
If you do that in Catholic canon law, you can't lawfully marry her.
Yeah.
So if King David were a Catholic today, he couldn't marry Bathsheba.
Pretty fascinating, actually.
It is. It makes a lot of sense to me, though.
Well.
We want to dissuade the murder of one's romantic rivals.
We're just relaying all this as a public service here.
Right, exactly.
So,
tip for the day, don't murder your romantic rival.
Don't do that.
Don't do that.
All right, Gerard, thanks so much for your email. If you'd like to send us an email for a future show, the address is ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we're going to get to Dante, a first-time listener in Texas, and we'll hopefully get to a lot of calls today on the program. 833-288-EWTN is that number, 833-288-3986, or text the letters EWTN to 58177. Back in a moment with the Thursday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Called a Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Thursday afternoon. Glad you're with us here on EWTN Radio. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. I have some breaking news for you. EWTN is expanding our mission on YouTube with brand new channels made just for you. We rolled this out on either Sunday or Monday. It is fantastic. Visit our main YouTube channel. Then you just go to YouTube and then type in EWTN and you'll see it. You can explore the new navigation bar and subscribe to the channels that speak to your heart. Hint, hint, radio, subscribe, radio. That's what you want to do. Whenever you're on your journey of faith, there is an EWTN channel for you. So do check it out. We're very excited about this wonderful new enhancement of our presence on YouTube. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Let's go to Dante, a first-time listener in Fredericksburg, Texas, listening to us there. Hey, Dante, what's on your mind today?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, go right ahead, Dante.
How's it? How are you doing? So, yeah, my name is Dante. I've been driving from Torrance, California, all the way to Louisiana because in my life so far, I feel like that's what God's will for me. He wants me to step out into this world and kind of make a life of my own. And so some quick backstory. So I'm from the Big Island of Hawaii. And I was raised up in a non-denominational church for about 2 years now. and I was discipled by my pastor. And so you asked if anybody had any questions about like the Catholic church and stuff, and I'm real interested because I was listening to you guys for a while, and you guys were talking about disciplining kids, and having kids is super how you say, I want kids a lot. And you know, one thing is I was never like really hit as a kid, but through like, you know, through talking to other fathers, through like even like watching my little cousin, like, and I know like from what I understand, like, don't spare the rod. And but one of the things is I was never hit as a kid, so I don't know, I don't want to overplay my hand and go from discipline to abuse. And so I don't know, it's just something that's pretty interesting to me, and I'm glad I got to talk about it and talk to you guys today. So if you could, maybe you could point me in some direction or give me some knowledge.
Yeah, sure. I really appreciate the question. So if your specific question is about the Catholic ethic on the corporal punishment of children, what I would tell you is that the Catholic Church as such does not have, as it were, an official stand on the question of the corporal punishment of children. And clearly, if you look through Catholic history, if you go back 2,000 years, as culture has changed from place to place, I think you would typically find that the style of Catholic parenthood has often followed whatever, you know, the trend in culture. And so there would be periods of Catholic history where that, you know, authoritarian parenthood or corporal punishment of children would be much more common, periods where it would be less common. But what the Church says, more importantly, when you're trying to ascertain the morality of an act, and this is more specifically than the question, should I use corporal punishment or not, I would like you to get your head wrapped around this concept. How do I decide what the moral thing to do is? Catholics and Protestants, and Catholics and non-denominational Christians, answer that question differently. It's often the case with non-denominational Christians that when they want to answer a moral question, they go searching through the Bible and they try to find a verse of Scripture that they think speaks to their issue. And if it kind of tells them, you know, what their intuition is on this, and they see the verse that conforms to it, they go, okay, well, God's Word says I should do X, I'm going to do X. And you cited a verse. You cited the text of Scripture that says, you know, just don't spare the rod, or that's a paraphrase of a Scripture text, that don't spare the rod, you'll spoil the child, you know. Or really, it's what the proverb says is, you know, that, you know, the man who withholds discipline from his son hates him, and this kind of thing. And so there's a culture that's grown up in evangelical Protestantism that really valorizes corporal punishment, and it cites Scripture in defense for that notion, okay? That's not the way Catholics go about making moral decisions, all right? The Catholic way is to say, yeah, we reverence the Holy Bible, to be sure, okay? But ultimately, the moral good is the good that tends most to human flourishing. And so that's something that you can use your reason to ascertain. You're not restricted to the data of the Bible. You're allowed, in fact, you're encouraged to import what does reason tell you about the human good in this circumstance. And so a Catholic is allowed, in fact, encouraged to look at things like, well, you know, maybe the discipline of psychology or sociology or medical science has learned things, you know, in the last 150 years that could enhance our understanding of what tends to human flourishing. And I'll give you a good example. You know, you go back 100 years ago, many Catholic moral theologians would have told you, you know, there's no problem drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes. You know, have at it, bud. In fact, you know, there were actually manuals of pastoral theology 150 years ago that said, if somebody's depressed, you know, encourage them to have a glass of beer or, you know, a shot of whiskey, calm them down, right? Well, today, through medical science, we know that's really bad advice, right?
Yeah.
And so Catholic moral theology says, you know, we weren't restricted to the data of the Bible. We learned from the science that that's bad advice. You're not going to find Catholic priests telling people to take a shot of whiskey or smoke a cigarette, right? Because we know that's really bad for you. We know that, right? And in the same way, I'd say there was a previous generation of Catholics that probably felt pretty strongly that there were no issues with corporal punishment. You know, have at it, beat the stew out of them and get them in line, right? you're not going to get my personal opinion, and this is not some official Catholic line, but I've read a lot of research on this. And on balance, what the research data shows is that the corporal punishment of children is not an effective strategy for helping them to flourish. And when you look at the outcomes between kids that had a lot of corporal punishment versus those that don't, the ones that were subjected to corporal punishment are more prone to depression, anxiety, to be in abusive relationships themselves, mm-hmm. lower grades, worse concentration. Kids that were not corporally punished typically do not suffer from those problems to the same extent. Now, there are outliers in every sample. So there are definitely going to be kids who were subject to corporal punishment who turn out fine. And they'll say, well, my parents beat me and I'm fine. All right. There are always going to be kids that weren't punished in that way. And they'll say, well, you know, they did not turn out fine. And, you know, you can cherry pick examples. But on balance, to the best of my ability to discern, having read the scientific literature, it does not tend to human flourishing. It doesn't tend to the welfare of kids. And I'll give you what I think are some better alternatives. Okay. You know, when I was growing up, I grew up not Catholic. I grew up in a Protestant church. They beat the snot out of us all the time, right? Constantly. In my school, in my home, and they quoted the Bible, and they said, spare the rod, spoil the child, and, you know, it was a big thing. And, in fact, parents had to sign a release form to send their kids to the Christian school that gave the school permission to whack on them, you know? And I got whacked on a lot, okay? And you know, if you threaten to beat on me, here was my response. If there was something that I was supposed to do or not do, and the consequence was getting beat on, of course, I was going to do my dead level best to avoid getting beaten. All right?
Sure.
Did it make me value the thing that was being commanded or forbidden? You know? No. No. What it made me do was resent authority.
Yeah.
And I viewed the prohibition with bitterness as a constraint that I had to adhere to avoid the unpleasant consequence. But I typically despised the person who was beating on me. I despised the standard or the rule that they laid down as the basis for it. And very often, I experienced the application of corporal punishment as arbitrary and unreasoning. And not in the case of my parents, but with other authorities, very often conferred by people who I felt quite certainly did not love me. And I have a lot of really vivid memories. Some of them are probably unseemly that I won't share on the air. And that's another problem with corporal punishment. Sometimes it can bring in some unseemly characteristics that can really traumatize kids. And some of that happened to me. But one, I think it's more benign and I can share it. I think I was in about second grade in my Christian school, my Presbyterian Christian school.
Uh-huh.
And I was in class. And without being consciously aware of what I was doing, I was humming under my breath. And I didn't even know I was humming under my breath. I didn't even know I was humming under my breath, but I was doing it. And then suddenly it began to annoy the teacher. And she looked up kind of angry and she said, "Who is singing?" And I had taught, you know, the good child never tells a lie, you know, and I thought nothing of it. And I raised my hand. No simple, you know, "Would you please stop? That's rude. I can't concentrate." I was yanked out of my seat, you know, taken out into the hall and beaten.
Wow.
And I felt very unjustly treated because I hadn't done it with malice at all. I would have stopped if I'd been asked. And in hindsight, I'm almost certain that the reason I got that kind of treatment was that I was a kind of a precocious kid, not very physically attractive, who had a habit of asking uncomfortable questions of my teachers. That's why I grew up to become a Catholic apologist, right? And I think that you know, that I attracted unfavorable attention. If someone else in my class had done the very same thing, they would not have gotten that treatment.
Really?
I think so. I'm almost positive of that.
Okay.
Right? And it's too often easy for adult figures to use corporal punishment not as a way to legitimately discipline children, but to vent their own anger and frustration. And it's too easy. I mean, the advice is always never do it in anger. Always show them that you love them. All this kind of thing. But parents don't do that. They say they're going to do that, but then they punish in anger, right? The child learns that, you know, this is how mommy acts when she's mad.
Mm-hmm.
And it can even be worse when it is applied in a way that's kind of arbitrary or tyrannical or unreasoning. And then it's covered over with this veneer of, but you know, I'm really only doing this because I love you. And it sends a very mixed message about the nature of love. It's much, 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 much harder as a parent to actually inculcate habits of virtue and of loving the values that will help this child tend to flourish over the long term. That can only be done by example, by cooperation, by goodwill and positive relationship. It's really easy to pick up a stick and hit someone. It's really hard to model humility and patience and kindness and hard work and faithfulness and industriousness and not losing your temper and not answering back in anger. Those are the kind of behaviors that you really want your kid to have. Those things are not evoked in the parent or the child, in my opinion, through the use of corporal punishment. And, you know, with my own kids, I've got five children and a couple grandkids, and my parenting style has become less harsh and more permissive the more kids I have. And the outcomes I have gotten have been better and better as I focus more on the quality of relationship and less on, you know, my way or the highway, bud.
Yeah.
I get more of my way.
How about that?
I get more of what I'm looking for out of a child who feels safe and secure and loved and accompanied than I do from one who feels like, you know, he's locked in a kind of battle of wills with this stronger person with an arm of steel.
Dante, is that helpful for you?
Yeah, it is, and it was only a real question of mine just because I was never hit as a kid, and I remember my thinking, like, my friends were so much more, like, at times, my friends were so much more mature, and, like they could control themselves a lot better than, like, me when I was a kid, and I remember, everybody I've ever talked to, they're like, oh, I'm lucky I got hit as a kid because it made me a lot more respectful and this or that. And I don't know if that's one of those kind of worldly sayings where it's like, you know, like, hey, I'm this and this and I'm tough because I got hit as a kid and you're soft, you know, I got hit as a kid or whatever. And
yeah,
I think it was something worth asking and curious about it.
So the criteria that you just advanced, you know, that you've known people who said they were beat as children and you thought they had some personal qualities that you lacked that you would like to have had, that's interesting. That's an anecdote, but it could also very well be a case of, you know, of a logical fallacy of assuming that just because two things are correlated that there's necessarily a causal relation, right? Those kids may have had those qualities for some reason other than the fact that they were beaten. That's why when you do scientific studies, you can control for spurious correlation, right? And so the psychologists who are expert at doing this have conducted the wide-scale studies, and they're able to tease out statistical significance. And what the statistical data show is that on balance in general, kids who are corporally punished have worse psychological outcomes over time than those that are not.
Dante, great question. Thanks so much for your call. And keep listening to your Guadalupe radio station there in your area. It's a great station, and we're on stations from coast to coast. So just keep it here on EWTN. Thanks so much for your call. Hey, that opens up a line for you as well at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Are you listening to us in Australia? Well, we've got a number for you. 1-205-271-2985 anywhere outside of North America. And as previously mentioned, you can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. We would love to talk with you on this Thursday afternoon if you've got a question for Dr. David Anders. A lot of people have questions about the Catholic faith. They just, as the kids say now, they don't know what they don't know. So let us help you with that. 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. Do stay with us. Called to Communion in Progress on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Lines are open for you right now at 833 888-EWTN if you have a question for David. Maybe you'd like to explain to us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. Maybe you have been a Methodist all your life, or any other language, any other faith, fill in the blank. But you've been looking at the Catholic faith and you'd say, gee, if it wasn't for X, I would become a Catholic tomorrow. Well, what is X? Let's talk about that. 833-288-3986. Here's a quick question from Jim in Arlington, Texas. Dr. Anders, it's my understanding the Catholics are not supposed to proselytize. So what is the difference between proselytizing and evangelizing?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you exactly the difference, and I'll illustrate with a story. When I was an evangelical Protestant, I once took a class it was a GRE prep class, preparing for grad school exams.
Okay.
And I was in there with people from different programs, and I met a woman in that class who was a practicing Catholic, and I was a practicing Protestant. When I met her, my first thought was, you know, oh, goody, goody, here's somebody I can work on and get them to, you know, become an evangelical Protestant. And if they're Catholic, that'll be an extra feather in my cap. You know, I bagged a papist, you know, that'd be fantastic. and so I got to know this person briefly and used every rhetorical tool in my handbag to mess her up, confuse her theologically, and to manipulate her to praying the sinner's prayer and to affirming the propositions that I wanted her to affirm. And I succeeded. And when I've spoken about this publicly before, I say, and you know what her name was? You know what her name was, Tom?
What was her name?
I don't know. You know why?
Why?
I didn't care about her.
Wow. Wow.
I didn't care about her as a human being. I don't know why she was so pliable to some, you know, arrogant 25-year-old kid. I don't know, you know, what was missing in her Catholic formation. I don't know what her family life was like. I don't know what struggle she might have had. I don't know what her spiritual concerns were. I don't know what her life of virtue looked like, because I didn't care. Because for me, she was just a mark, you know, like a carnival barker or an Amway salesman looking for somebody to sell goods to, you know. It was just an opportunity for me to self-aggrandize and test out my theological and rhetorical skills, and see if I could, if I had it within me to defeat somebody rhetorically in debate and manipulate them into seeing my point of view, right? I really didn't care about her long-term spiritual welfare at all. And that's proselytism. Proselytism is the goal of manipulating somebody else, you know, using any means possible, to coming around to your perspective. Now, if the Christian faith were a matter of holding a certain set of propositions, that's all that mattered. At the end of the day, the only thing that matters is, you know, do you check the box, you know, on the ideological checklist, right? And if that was what Christianity was, well, you know, then proselytism, I guess, would be justifiable in those terms, mm-hmm, right? If I could get into heaven by just checking a bunch of boxes. But that's not what, and that was my conception of evangelical Protestantism. Just check the boxes and you're good, right? All right, but that's not the Catholic faith. The Catholic faith has always opposed Gnosticism. We're not saved by the content of our ideology or by what we know. Thomas A. Kempis once wrote, "I would rather feel contrition than know the definition thereof."
Yeah.
What good does it do you if you can define the Trinity if you're an arrogant boor and therefore displeasing to the Trinity? They were saved not by the content of the knowledge in our heads, but by the quality of our character, whether we have taken the mind of Christ, come to be conformed to his likeness and image in love and charity, mm-hmm, and the virtues. And to actually bring someone to the capacity to love their neighbor, to forgive their enemies, to live lives of justice and be peace seekers, you cannot manipulate someone into that position, right? It takes a complete transformation of their interior life and their sensibility. And that really can only be accomplished through loving relationship, through trust, through accompaniment, and through deep care. And if that's your ultimate goal, you know, I'm more interested in the question, how can you and I mutually help one another to become better human beings, right, than I am, what can I do to make sure that you and I check the same box on, you know, religion at the bottom of the hospital intake form?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, I'm Catholic because I think that being Catholic is the most efficient way for me to grow in virtue and charity, right? But the end goal is the growth in virtue and charity. St. Augustine of Hippo, doctor of the church, said that the whole dispensation of our faith, of Catholicism, we should regard as a means to an end. The end being the transformation in charity. Now, it's a divinely instituted means. It's the one that Christ gave to us to change the human race and to restore the image, the lost image and likeness of God in us, right, through the sacraments, through the teaching of the church, through the example of Christ and the atonement, the death of Christ. I mean, these are the divinely instituted means.
Yeah.
But they're just means. At the end of the day, the goal is the transformation, right? I mean, if I have all the means but don't have the transformation, then I'm missing out. You know, I could go to Mass every day. I could read the whole catechism cover to cover. I could pray the rosary 15 times in an hour. Well, probably not 15 times an hour, right? Prayed it really fast. You know, I could do all the Catholic stuff, but if I don't have love, St. Paul says I'm nothing.
For naught.
It's all for naught. You know, Francis de Sales has this wonderful book called On True Devotion. And he says, you know, some people think true devotion is fasting or prayer or giving alms or going to Mass. He says, it's none of those things. Those are all means to an end. True devotion is nothing other than the legitimate love of God and neighbor, right? If that's your goal, if that's what evangelism means to you, how do I genuinely help myself and this other person come to a deeper love of God and neighbor, which means always has got to mean deeper humility on my part? St. Teresa of Avila says, humility is the one thing you can never let go of if you want to grow in holiness. Always has to be there, right?
Yep.
How can I come to deeper humility, right? Which means I don't step into every relationship thinking, I've got something that you need to hear. See, that's how I used to be, me personally. I've got something you need to hear. I need to approach my relationships, I think, saying, you've got something I need to hear. How can you challenge me, you know, to have a clearer view of who I am?
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, I may think I'm all fantastic, but, you know, there's some hole in my self-conception. I'm missing something. There's some artificiality about my person. Something that's making me objectify other human beings. It's keeping me from recognizing their full humanity and appreciating who they are and where they're coming from. I need to know what that is in me so I can get rid of it. Help me do that. Show me something about myself and something beautiful about you that I need to know. That's the attitude of somebody who's really got the heart for evangelism.
Sure.
The proselytizer just wants to manipulate others.
Jim, in Arlington, Texas, thanks so much for your question today via email. That address again, ctc@ewtn.com. So as you were laying all this out, David, I started to think about this young woman who you were, you know, so convincing with back in the day in what, Iowa or wherever.
That was Illinois. At that time it was Illinois.
Imagine if she was listening to this show today and she thought, oh my goodness, he's talking about me.
I wonder.
Wouldn't that be something?
You know, I hope that 24 hours after meeting me, she shook her head and cleared her thoughts and went, what was I thinking? You know, I'm going back to Mass, buddy.
That's the way to go. Let's go to Mark in Texas, listening on Sirius XM, channel 130. Hey, Mark. Mark, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yeah, first of all, really excellent conversation, and it leads into my question, which is, we have a men's spiritual growth group at our church. And, you know, we look at a lot of different things, and one of the things that we're doing over the next several weeks is connected to Dr. Shree's Biblical Walk Through the Mass series. And I'm calling because between that and Dr. Scott Hahn's books, these are men that are, you know, probably haven't had any catechisms since they were in CCD. They're in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. And I'm calling because I want to make sure I don't have any blind spots around what we should be, what other materials might be out there to do some kind of a biblical walk series. And I wanted to get Dr. Andrew's opinion on the lineup of those things.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, you know, a book that I really like in terms of understanding the structure of the Bible is John Bergesma's book, Bible Basics for Catholics. I think it's a great book.
It's good stuff.
It's real short.
Yeah.
It's very easy to understand. I really highly appreciate it. You know, of course, you mentioned Dr. Hahn and Dr. Shree. I mean, you know, people eat those guys up with spoons.
Yeah.
I mean, we do around here. You know, they're great folks. They've been at EBTN many times. You know, Dr. Brant Petrie. Is another one that is getting a lot of traction these days. People love to read him.
Yeah,
the Catholic biblical scholar, you know. But the important thing is read. Now, I personally think that more Catholics ought to be familiar with the classics of the Catholic tradition, the doctors and the fathers of the Church. Many of them are quite engaging, right? I mean, so people like Francis de Sales and Alphonsus Liguori and Ignatius of Loyola, and for that matter, Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine. I mean, this literature is perennial. I mean, these guys are doctors of the Church. Pope Leo just named Cardinal Newman, John Henry Cardinal Newman, as a doctor of the church. I mean, his parochial and plain sermons are some of the most edifying literature you'll ever read, even though he wrote them before he was Catholic. He was on his way to being Catholic, and they're just fantastic stuff, right? Another modern writer, a spiritual writer that people get a lot of good mileage out of, is Jacques Philippe. He's not doing biblical walks through the Mass, but he is getting into the interior life and the life of prayer. You know, there's really no end of good catechetical materials, you can pick them off the bestseller lists of Catholic publishers, which is, you know, kind of where Hahn and Schri are, or you can dig into the depths of the tradition and read the big boys like Augustine and St. Thomas. But I commend you for your efforts to help catechize and educate young men in the faith.
Well, there you go. And thanks so much for your question. Call to Communion here on EWTN. May I tell you about another one of our wonderful weekend programs here on the network, and that would be Mother Angelica, Answering the Call, Sundays at 2 and 8 p.m. Eastern, only on EWTN Radio. Timeless words of wisdom from our foundress, Mother Angelica, featuring the best of Mother's advice to listeners. It's hosted by Father Joseph Mary and Doug Keck. It is a wonderful, wonderful series, and of course, anything that Mother Angelica taught back in the day is timeless to this day. So I can certainly recommend it wholeheartedly. Mother Angelica, Answering the Call, Sunday, 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. right here on EWTN Radio. Got a great email. Well, let me give you the phone numbers first. 833-288-EWTN. We can get in a few more calls here. 833-288-3986. All right. Here's this question now from Diane. She says, Dr. Anders and Mr. Price, in the first reading from Numbers on the Feast of the Exaltation of the Cross, we hear how lifting their head to look at the serpent on a pole could save those bitten by seraph serpents. Since this is intended to be a type of the cross, and the serpent and the pole are required together to save those bitten, why is it that Protestants celebrate the cross without Christ? And is this why Catholics continue to utilize the crucifix as the center of our worship space? Thanks both for your incredible show. We endeavor never to miss it. We teach in our parish. We often encourage those in attendance to listen most attentively to Call to Communion. Thanks, Diane.
Yeah, thanks, Diane. Appreciate the question. So not all Protestants removed the corpus from the cross. The Lutherans did not remove the corpus from the cross. Many Episcopalians did not remove the corpus from the cross. It is specifically Protestants in the Reformed tradition, that is the tradition that came out of Zurich and Geneva, Switzerland, and became predominant in France and Holland,
okay,
often associated with the name of John Calvin, but there are other figures in Reformed tradition as well, although Calvin is the big one. And the reason they took the corpus off of the cross is that Zwingli had worked out an argument against idolatry that he thought included the use of any kind of imagery in sacred worship. And there, you know, we can argue about why Zwingli came to that position. Some people, myself included, think that Zwingli had some philosophical presuppositions drawn from Neoplatonism that made him prejudiced against any kind of material props in worship. Calvin would have picked that up from Zwingli just because that was kind of in the air and that was his tendency. There was a reaction against a certain kind of exuberance in Catholic popular devotion towards the material props of worship, whether they be images or relics and these kinds of things. And there were Catholic excesses. There were Catholic writers at the time in the 16th century that lampooned some silly things that Catholics did at the time. Erasmus of Rotterdam, who was a Catholic, never left the Catholic Church, wrote a magnificent little piece of satire called "In Praise of Folly," and it was just a catalog of all the silly things that people were doing, you know, in the Catholic Church. And I'll give you an example of one of the silly things that was going on. This is something that Eamon Duffy documents in his book "Stripping of the Altars." There was a popular superstition. This is false, of course, but it was a popular superstition at the time that if you saw the elevation of the host, you would not die on the day that you saw the elevation of the host. Well, I mean, people obviously die on the days they see the elevation of the host, and it's not true, right? But there was this popular superstition that if you saw the elevated host, you wouldn't die that day.
Really?
Yep. And it created this mass demand to see as many elevations in a day as you could.
Okay.
And you had some Catholic dioceses where people would literally run, they'd figure out when the masses were going to be held, and they would run from parish to parish just in time for the elevation. They'd run in, they'd watch the elevation, they'd run out, and then they'd go to the next one. And okay. they were trying to, you know, they'd rack up as many elevation sightings in a day as they could. Well, that is obviously not the way to go to Mass, you know?
This reminds me of the drug dealers who would wear 15 scapulars.
Exactly, that kind of thing. You
it's
know?
Like, okay.
So that kind of stuff happened, you know? And so, you know, both because of those Neoplatonic prejudices that Zwingli had, as well as maybe some devotional overreach, if you will, by some over-enthusiastic but superstitious Catholics, this ideology emerged within the Reformed tradition that you shouldn't have material props in worship, and that would include not only the relics of the saints or images, but even the corpus on the cross. And the way they tried to justify it was by a renumbering of the Ten Commandments, where they broke out the prohibition on graven images from the First Commandment and made it its own commandment, is commandment number 2, and then conflated commandments 9 and 10 into, you know, don't covet your neighbor's wife, don't covet your neighbor's aardvark, and they put those in the same category, right? Whereas the Catholic Church thinks that wives and aardvarks are very different, right?
Leave my aardvark alone.
Leave my aardvark alone, exactly. So if you grew up in the Presbyterian Church, you know, you would learn that that God has forbidden, this is their position, that God has forbidden us to use any representational art in worship. The position, and that's the justification for it.
Okay.
Now, in modern Protestants have forgotten all that history. And I, when I was a kid growing up, I mean, my parents told me, well, you know, Catholics have Jesus on the cross because they don't believe, they've forgotten that Jesus rose from the dead. We take Jesus off the cross because we know he rose from the dead. Well, that's absurd. Catholics know he rose from the dead. Easter is our biggest celebration of the year, right?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. That's got nothing to do with the history. The history is an argument about idolatry and whether you should use material props in worship. And, you know, they would bring in, different parties might bring in the interpretation of the Old Testament in Numbers 1, the elevation of the serpent, that kind of thing for commentary. But it really had to do with this issue that was unique to 16th century Geneva and Zurich and the ideology that emerged therefrom.
Diane, thanks so much for your email. We do appreciate that. Glad to hear from you. We're going to go now to another Diane. This is Diane in Cocoa Beach, Florida, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey there, Diane. What's on your mind today? Diane in Cocoa Beach, are you there?
Oh, hi. Yeah.
Go right ahead.
All right. So my question is, my sister recently passed away, and she was not a practicing Catholic, but she believed in God and Jesus. And she wanted her ashes scattered, which I cannot do. I'm in charge of this, and I can't do it because I am a practicing Catholic. However, I called my church to have a mass said for her, and they will not do it because she does not want to be buried in a cemetery. Or I don't know how to say the word, columbarium.
Columbarium,
Yeah. So, but, you know, every time I go to church, the first thing that's said is everyone's welcome. So I'm just wondering why the church won't give someone who is Catholic, although not a practicing Catholic, a mass.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the question. First of all, I'm really very sorry for the death of your sister. I'm very sorry. My heart goes out to you. My condolences. I am not aware of any reason why the church could not, why a priest could not say a mass for the repose of her soul. And in fact, I think that you will be able to find a priest who will say a mass for the repose of her soul. Could she have the full Catholic funeral rites, which is a different question? You know, it's not just having a mass said for her, but having a Catholic funeral. I think it would be a judgment call on the part of the priest. And the thinking would be this, okay? I'm not for or against the priest's decision. I'm just trying to explain it to you.
Okay.
The church draws a distinction between people who profess the Catholic faith and people who don't. It is not saying that if you don't profess the Catholic faith, you're not going to heaven. That's for God to judge, not us. All right. But, you know, the rites of the church are for Catholics. Right now, the position "everybody's welcome" is true insofar as everybody's welcome to come investigate the Catholic Church and decide whether they want to be Catholic or not. Right? I mean, we're not going to hold. It doesn't matter if you're white or black or tall or short or rich or poor or male or female. Whoever you are, you're welcome to come into the church. We welcome you to become Catholic. If you choose not to become Catholic, we still love you. And, you know, God will judge my soul. God will judge your soul. We're not judging you. We're not saying you're a bad person because you didn't become Catholic. But you're not Catholic, right? You chose not to be Catholic. You're not Catholic, right? And so, you know, I'm not going to admit, say, a non-Catholic to Holy Communion. If they say, I don't believe the Catholic faith, I'm not going to associate with the Catholic faith. Well, you know, to receive communion in the Catholic Church is to say, I do believe the Catholic faith. I do associate with the Catholic faith. I'm not judging you if you don't do that. I'm just saying, well, this is for people who believe the Catholic faith, right? And you know, usually a pretty good indicator of whether or not someone professes Catholicism is if they agree to what the church teaches. If someone says, yeah, I agree to what the church teaches, that's a pretty good indicator that, yeah, they're Catholic. If somebody says, no, I reject what the church teaches, it's a pretty good indicator they're not. And on the issue of Catholic burials, if someone says, I reject the church's teaching on the disposition of the remains, well, that might be a clue that, you know, okay, this person is not Catholic. They're rejecting the church. And I'm not condemning them to hell. I'm not judging them. I'm not saying they're a bad person, but the rites of the church are for those who, everybody's welcome to come investigate. Everybody's welcome to come in where anybody could potentially become Catholic. This is someone who chose not to become Catholic. Now, so the full funeral rites of the church would not be applicable in that case if the priest were to form that judgment. It doesn't mean that you can't have a mass said for the repose of her soul. You could ask a priest privately, could you pray Mass for the repose of my sister's soul, and that could happen.
Diane, thanks so much for your call from Cocoa Beach. What a beautiful area that is. It is Called to Communion here on EWTN. Got a call from April in New Mexico, who couldn't stay on the line, but she left us this question. With schizoaffective disorder, people hear voices. If they get closer to God, will they ever go away? I guess that means the voices. Will the voices go away?
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the question. So most psychotic disorders, as far as I understand, they're not just a sort of psychological dysregulation. They actually involve biochemical differences in the brain. It's why they respond to medication, right? And the typical antipsychotic medication works by reducing dopamine in the brain. And I'm gonna go out on a limb, and if you are a psychiatrist or a neurologist, then you can absolutely call me and tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about. Right? So this part of the statement is just me trying to reason through this.
Sure.
Dopamine has to do with the way we pay attention to stuff and take an interest in things. You know, you eat a sugary cake, it tastes delicious. The next time you see a cake, you get this dopamine spike as you kind of crave the cake. You know, it directs your attention to things. Now, people who are psychotic have a very hard time distinguishing between perception, memory, and imagination. We all have perception, memory, and imagination, but most of us are able to focus in on reality and to screen out memory and imagination. It's not that they go away. It's just we're able to relegate them to a lesser status and know that they're not central, right?
Yeah.
People who are schizophrenic can't do that, and so something appears in memory or imagination, and they can't distinguish it from reality. Now, the thing about the dopamine, I wonder, this is just my question, I don't know the answer to this, you know, by reducing dopamine, does that mean that the person grows in the capacity to differentiate what is, you know, actually of relevance and then what's just, you know, ephemeral noise in the background? And so, you know, I think all of us, even if you're not schizophrenic, even if you're not psychotic, you have, as it were, voices in your head. It's just, you know, that they're not, you know, your angry neighbor projecting aliens into your brain, right? You just, you know, it's just, that's just a random thought that popped in my head. You're able to differentiate, right? But again, this is a function of a biochemical dysregulation in the brain, not just kind of psychological, you know, maladaption. Being holy, growing in holiness, knowing God, growing in virtue, does not necessarily automatically cure physical ailments. You know, if I'm an amputee and I grow close to God, I'm not going to just grow new legs because I'm growing close to God, right? You know, if I have type 2 diabetes, growing close to God is not necessarily going to cure my pancreas. I don't see any reason to think that growing closer to God would necessarily regulate the dopaminergic system in my brain. Right? That's a physical disorder. Okay. Now, the better question, I think, is can I come to holiness if I have a psychotic disorder? And the answer to that question is yes. And there are saints that are examples to us. So if you don't know him, look up Saint Benoît Joseph Labre. Benoît Joseph Labre. He was a madman. He was psychotic. He was holy. And he was a saint. And he died a saint. And the church venerates him as such. And he is the patron of those who have mental illness.
Wow. April in New Mexico, thanks so much for your call. Dr. David Anders, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
We do it right here on EWTN at 2 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow on the Friday edition of Call to Communion. God bless.